tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
Alright, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. This is part 33 of our continuing series on Henry Ford's The International Jew. That is the four-volume set. That's right, this is not the abridged version, this is the full version in total detail. I am Ted Midward, this is RadioAryan.com. In our previous segments, we went over articles discussing how the Jews, the international Rothschild financial Jews, like Max, Paul Warburg, and Kuhn, Loeb & Company, got a hold of the Federal Reserve and thus got control of the money and credit system of the United States. For today's episode, we're going to switch gears and talk about how the Jews gained control of the American liquor traffic. The first half of today's episode starts with an article breaching that subject, and at the top of the page, we have a quote from Lazare. Here it is. United, then, by the strongest feelings of solidarity, the Jews can easily hold their own in this disjointed and anarchic society of ours. If the millions of Christians by whom they are surrounded were to substitute the same principle of cooperation for that of individual competition, the importance of the Jew would immediately be destroyed. The Christian, however, will not adopt such a course, and the Jew must inevitably, I will not say dominate, that's the favorite expression of the anti-Semites, but certainly possess the advantage over others and exercise the supremacy against which the anti-Semites inveigh without being able to destroy it. End quote. That's from Lazare. How the Jews gained an American liquor control. Here we go. To those who have been surprised and confounded by the widespread evidence, which even the newspapers have been unable to suppress, that the bulk of the organized bootlegging which is being carried on in this country is in the hands of the Jews, it would have been less of a surprise had they known the liquor history of this country. The claim made for the Jews, that they are a sober people, is undoubtedly true. But that has not prevented two facts concerning them, namely that they usually constitute the liquor dealers of the countries where they live in numbers, and that, in the United States, they are the only people exempted from the operations of the Prohibition Law. Here, as elsewhere, the principle holds true that the Jew is the key. The demoralization which struck the liquor business, causing its downfall, and the demoralization which has struck prohibition enforcement for a time, cannot be understood without a study of the racial elements which contributed to both phenomena. If, in what follows, the Jews find objectionable elements, they should remember that their own people put them there. It is impossible to doubt that if the organized Jews of the United States were to make 1,000th of the protest against the illegal liquor activities of their own people that they make against the perfectly legal and morally justifiable exposures being made in the Dearborn Independent, the result would be not only favorable, but immediate. There was a time when the term whiskey had a much more respectable connotation than it has today. There was a time when to use whiskey, and even to make it, were customs sanctioned by the better class of public opinion. It is a common explanation of the difference between then and now that people of the latter period became more sensitive morally than their forebears, that whereas the previous generation guzzled its whiskey, innocently oblivious of the evil in it, the latter generation developed a stronger discrimination and banned the custom. The truth is this. The people didn't become better, the whiskey became worse. When the entire story of the people's justifiable indignation is written, the competent historian will trace along with the people's rising disgust the whiskey's decreasing quality. Attention to this matter will materially assist in understanding of the fact that Jews and bootlegging are so continuously and prominently connected in the public print these days. Readers of the old romances know how proud the master was of his wines. Vintages ripened under certain skies, on certain hills, where certain waters flowed, with cellarage in certain soils, had a faculty of aging gracefully, mellowing to a smoothness and purity and desirableness that made for cheer and health without the alloy of sordid inebriety. The bouquet of wine, the perfected essence of the grape, subjected to the further courses of nature, has been a theme of praise for centuries. If it were uttered today, the source of the utterance would be suspected, and very probably with good reason, of being in pay of the wets. For the vile stuff which civilization threw out is not at all the wine of popular custom and century-long esteem. Nevertheless, it is not difficult for even a modern to grasp the fact that there was an art in making wine and strong drink, in which art men took pride. That art required time, experience, and a love of good quality. It's a little difficult to speak of this art in connection with whiskey. Wine being a more poetic word, yet it is a matter of knowledge that three places in the world have devoted to the production of whiskey the same spirit that France and Portugal devoted to their wines. These three districts are Glenlivet in Scotland, the region of Dublin in Ireland, and the Bluegrass region of Kentucky. Why in these three regions? First, because there were men, non-Jews of course, who were willing to wait 10 years to produce a good article. Second, the waters of these regions are of a quality which is beautifully adapted to the making of pure goods. Pure whiskey, it should be remembered, is a vegetable product matured by natural forces and no other. Grain, water, and time. Not even artificial heat added, nor any other thing, completes the best whiskey product. In older times in America, there were men who were as choice of their whiskeys as of their horses or books. There was then such a thing as quality, but there was no such thing as delirium tremens. That came later, with the disappearance of pure whiskey. A distiller seldom grew rich. He was too engrossed in maintaining the quality of his product, and it consumed much time. There were certain brands known nationally because of their mildness and purity. Purest wine of the choicest grapes, aged in the best adapted cellars, was not more mild or pure. There are names that remain until this day. Pepper, Crow, Taylor, and others, the names of men who took time and pains, whose names became brands which guaranteed quality and purity. These men were distillers in the true sense, not manufacturers nor compounders, but distillers, in a time when distilling was both a science and an art, and not a mere name to conceal a gigantic fraud on the public. Let me stop and comment here. It's only because I've been watching gangster stuff lately from this time period, Prohibition, that I noticed this, I caught this, and you may be wondering, what are you talking about? What is Henry Ford and his editors talking about here with ruining the quality? Well, what they did, the bootleggers were, of course, only interested in making a profit. Alcohol was outlawed, therefore it was very profitable to sell it. And what they would do is, through the chain of buying and selling all the way down to the street dealer or the local dealer of it, they would take it and dilute it, add water to it so that they could increase the number of bottles that they sold, you see? So they'd start off with a good product, probably a like middle-of-the-road or upper-middle-of-the-road quality product, say whiskey. Then they'd take it and water it down by half and water it down by half again, and then water it so that they make more of it, they can sell more of it, and make more product. Essentially like what some high school kids do with their parents' vodka stash. They'll drink half the bottle, realize, oh God, my parents are going to find out. Let's fill the top half of the bottle up with water so that they won't notice just by looking at it. It's essentially what the Jews did with Prohibition. They watered it down so that they could increase the total supply and therefore sell more and make more money. Back to the text. In time to come, when the people's justifiable moral indignation will permit a study of the steps by which the reputation of whiskey came to its present low degree, they will see how much better it would have been, how much more efficacious and clarifying, if the attack on whiskey had included an exposure of the men who had driven whiskey out of the country and were selling rank poison as a substitute. The saloon, the brewer, the man who used strong drink, were all of them made the target for attack. The Jews, who demoralized the whole business, went on collecting their enormous and illegitimate profits without so much as their identity being revealed. Whiskey ceased to be whiskey, and beer grew less like beer. The results upon humanity became apparent and deplorable. So society raised the license fee and increased the restrictions. To meet this, the Jewish compounders turned out still cheaper stuff and still more vicious mixtures. Licenses went up and quality went down. The Jewish compounders always getting a larger margin of profit. And through the long, long fight, no one, with one or two notable exceptions, had the sense and the courage to point a finger at the solid racial phalanx lined up behind the whole rotten combination. Distilling is one of the long list of businesses which has been ruined by Jewish monopoly. Those who favor prohibition will probably thank the Jew for his work in that direction. It may be that the Jew is destiny's agent to demoralize the business that must pass away. But set against that, the fact that it is Jewish influence that demoralizes prohibition, too, and both wets and dries, have an interesting situation to consider. Wets and dries, I suppose those are people for and against prohibition. In general, the Jews are on the side of the liquor and always have been. They are the steadiest drinkers of all. That is why they were able to secure exemption from the prohibition laws. Their religious ceremonies require them to drink an amount which the law has considered to equal 10 gallons a year. Wow. And so the Prohibition Law of the United States, a part of the Constitution of the United States, is made legally ineffective to the extent of 10 gallons a year a Jew, per Jew. The amount, of course, is very much more. It is always easy to get 100 gallons through a 10-gallon loophole. In fact, thousands of gallons have come through that 10-gallon loophole. Well, this is interesting. I did not know that supposedly religious Jews or the Jews masquerading as a religious group had an exemption during Prohibition. I didn't know that. That makes a lot of sense. It will come to many people as new knowledge that the liquor business of the world has been in the hands of the Jews. In the United States, the liquor business was almost exclusively in the hands of Jews for the 25 years previous to Prohibition. During the period, in fact, when the liquor trade was giving point and confirmation to Prohibition arguments. This knowledge has an important bearing on the interpretation of our times. In the volume, The Conquering Jew, published by Funk and Wagnalls Company in 1916, John Foster Fraser writes this: "The Jews are masters of the whiskey trade in the United States. 80% of the members of the National Liquors Dealers Association are Jews. It has been shown that 60% of the business of distilling and wholesale trade in whiskey is in the hands of the Jews. As middlemen, they control the wine product of California. Jews visit the tobacco-growing states and buy up nearly all the leaf tobacco, so that the great tobacco companies have to buy the raw product from them. The Jews have a grip on the cigar trade. The American Tobacco Company manufactures about 15% of the cigars smoked in the United States. The Jews provide the rest. End quote. It was also true in Russia, Poland, and Romania. The Jewish Encyclopedia states that the establishment of government liquor monopoly in Russia in 1896 deprived thousands of Jewish families of a livelihood. They controlled the liquor traffic, the vodka business which undermined Russia. The government made the liquor business a national monopoly in order to abolish it, which was done. Liquor in Russia was Jewish, as the encyclopedia testifies. Anyone reading carefully the article on Russia, especially pages 527 and 559 in the Jewish Encyclopedia, will be in no doubt as to the fact. In Romania, the whole Jewish question was the liquor question. The land of the peasants came into control of the liquor sellers, and the business of handling liquors was a strict Jewish monopoly for years. In Poland, the same was true. It's not surprising, therefore, that in the United States, whiskey also became Jewish. For convenience in detailing this story, most of the observations made will center in the state of Kentucky. Almost everyone of age knows the phrase, "fine old Kentucky whiskeys." It was once a phrase that meant something. Kentucky produced, in her limestone regions, the kind of water that served best with the grain ingredients of whiskey. The word bourbon, mostly known as a kind of whiskey, is really the name of a county in Kentucky where bourbon whiskey was first made. How profoundly the region in which whiskey is manufactured affects the product may be gathered from the fact that a primitive Kentucky distiller named Shields, who became famous for a brand of bourbon made from the waters of Glen's Creek, conceived of the idea of lowering his costs by transferring his distillery to Illinois, where he would be nearer the rich cornfields. He was disappointed. Illinois water would not make bourbon. The rule of the region is supreme. Jamaica rum owes its characteristic to the waters of Jamaica. Port wine is best produced in the region of Douro in Portugal, champagne in the region of Reims in France, and beer in Bavaria. And so, in Kentucky, there was the right combination of elements which made the whiskey product of that state world famous. An alcohol spirit from grain may be made in any climate and by many methods. Neutral spirits, high wines, and alcohol are not indigenous anywhere. They can be made in any back room or cellar in very little time. Little care is required. A concoction of drugs and spirits, properly colored and flavored, fraudulently labeled whiskey and passed out over the bar, is a crime against the art of distilling, against the human nervous system, and against society. Readers may recall that in 1904, Dr. Wiley, then chief of the United States Bureau of Chemistry, had a great deal to say about this. But because he did not point out that the evil he was attacking was fostered by a single class of men bent on gain at the cost of ruin to an American industry and to countless thousands of American citizens, few people paid attention to him. The public supposed that Dr. Wiley was discussing a technical question which interested American distillers only. It vastly more interested the American citizen if he had but known it. If anyone had the clear vision and the courage to expose the great Jewish whiskey conspiracy. The difference between the non-Jewish and the Jewish method, as illustrated in the history of American whiskey, is thus described by Dr. Wiley. The aging of whiskey takes years of time. It's expensive. The whiskey leaks out. It is allowed to stand for 4 years at the least. The object of this is to permit the oxidation of the alcohols. There is a loss of interest on the value of the whiskey while it is aging. Hence, it's an expensive process. But the manufacture of compounded or artificial whiskey has for its purpose the avoiding of this long and expensive process. The makers begin with the pure article of spirits which can be made in a few hours. To this is added enough water to dilute it to the strength of whiskey. The next step is to color it. This is done by adding burnt sugar and caramel. The next thing is to supply the flavors. By the way, I have described, in 2 or 3 hours, the compounder can make a material which looks like, smells like, tastes like, and analyzes like genuine whiskey, but it has a different effect on the system. The people who drink this whiskey are much more liable to receive injury from it than those who drank the genuine article. All sorts of these practices were resorted to. Drugs and raw crops of whiskey were brought up in the business of rectifying, as it was called, began the ruin of the natural and wholesome process of distilling. Quick money, regardless of what happened to the customer. That was the motive of the rectifying business. This rectifying business was mostly Jewish. Here and there, a non-Jew was associated with Jewish partners, but rarely. The way had been found to trade on the reputation of the term whiskey by compounding a liquid which looked and tasted like whiskey, but the effect of which was harmful. That was the capital fraud, the capture of the name whiskey for a synthetic poison. There was a concealment of the meaning rectified spirits, a deceptive use of the word blend, and even a most fraudulent misrepresentation concerning aging. If chemical deception could be used to make a whiskey taste as if it were 9 years old, then it was advertised as 9 years in the wood. Here's a bit of Jewish court testimony. Question: is your make of whiskey 9 years old? Answer: 9 years old, but I want to explain in that respect that the whiskey may not have existed 9 years before it was put into that bottle. That brand of whiskey, which we brand as 9 years old blended, means that it is equal to a 9-year-old whiskey in smoothness and quality. Question: how did you arrive at the fact which you put upon this bottle that the whiskey was 9 years old? Answer: 'cause it is comparatively 9 years old. Question: how do you arrive at that result? Answer: by sampling. You take the whiskey that is allowed to remain in the original package for 9 years and compare it with our 9-year-old blend, and you will find them in smoothness the same. Therefore, we class it as 9-year-old whiskey. Let the reader form his own judgment on that type of mind. The whiskey bore a name, resembling a time-honored brand of pure goods, and it flaunted the name Kentucky, when it was not whiskey at all, was not a Kentucky product, but was compounded of neutral spirits from Indiana, prune juice from California, rock candy from anywhere, and raw Illinois whiskey from Peoria to give it flavor. Although Louisville, Kentucky became headquarters of whiskey men, it was Cincinnati, Ohio, a thoroughly Judaized city, which became a greater headquarters for the pseudo-whiskey men, the compounders, mixers, and rectifiers. The list of Cincinnati liquor dealers reads like a directory of the Warsaw Ghetto. In Louisville, the Judaic complexion of the city, as well as society, is very noticeable. Indeed, most of the leading Jews in the whiskey business are now Kentucky colonels, quote-unquote. The Jewish character of the whiskey business since the Civil War may be visualized by the simple expedient of noting how many of the better-known brands have been at various dates under Jewish control. Bear with us, here's a long list. There's Old 66, owned by Strauss, Pritz & Company. How about Highland Rye, owned by Freeburg & Wharkum? T.W. Samuel Old Style Sour Mash, owned by Max Hirsch, the Star Distilling Company. Bridgewater Sour Mash and Rye Whiskies. Rosewood and Westbrook Bourbon Whiskies, distilled by J. and A. Freiberg. T.J. Monarch and Davies County Sour Mash Whiskies, controlled by J. and A. Freiberg. Lewis Hunter 1870, Crystal Wedding and Old Jug, blended by J. and A. Freiberg. Ganymede 76, put out by Sigmund and Saul H. Freiberg. Jigsaw Kentucky Corn Whiskey, Lindale Whiskey, Brunswick Rye and Bourbon by Hofheimer Brothers Company. Red Top Rye and White House Club by Ferdinand Westheimer and Sons. Green River came into the control of by E. LeMontagne. Sunnybrook, a widely advertised brand on whose advertising matter a man in a United States inspector's uniform stood behind as if endorsing it, was at the time owned by Rosenfield Brothers and Company. Mount Vernon, as from the Hannis Distilling Company, was at the time owned by Angelo Meyer. Bell of Nelson came into control of the Jewish Trust, which was brought to legal birth by Levy Mayer and Alfred Austrian, the latter being the Chicago attorney, whose name will be recalled in connection with the baseball articles in this series. James E. Pepper was owned by James Wolfe. Cedarbrook was owned by Julius Kessler and Company. It was formerly the old W.H. McBrayer brand, but the real W.H. McBrayer, knowing the new methods that were arising in liquor making, requested in his will that his name should not be used as a brand after he had ceased to see that the product was worthy of his name. Wise choice. In the Pittsburgh and Peoria districts, the same story held true. The alleged whiskey made in those districts was controlled, with one exception, by Jews. The Great Western Distillery in Peoria is owned by a corporation of Jews. Two of its brands were Ravenswood Rye and Ravenswood Bourbon. The Woolner Distillery made Old Grove Whiskey and Old Rhine Whiskey and Bucha Gin. In the city of Peoria alone, there are 15 great fortunes, all held by Jews, and for the most part made in what passed in Peoria for whiskey. Take the city of Cincinnati alone and note what even an incomplete list reveals as to the names of the men classified as distillers. Bernheim, Rexinger & Company, Elias Bloke & Sons, J&A Freiberg, Freiberg and Warkum, Helferich and Sons, Hofheimer Brothers Company, Elias Hyman and Sons, Kaufman Bear and Company, Klein Brothers, A. Loeb and Company, H. Rosenthal and Sons, Seligman Distilling Company, Strauss Pritz and Company, S. M. Weil and Company, and F. Westheimer and Sons, with many other Jews concealed under fancy trade names and corporation designs. It's the same throughout Ohio, which state, incidentally, is one of the most Jew-ridden states in the Union. The lists here given do not by any means begin to indicate the number of the Jews who were engaged in the liquor business. They only indicate the complexion which the business takes on when a search is made behind the brands and the trade names. Any citizen in any city of size will have no trouble in confirming the statement that most of the rectifiers and wholesalers and brokers in the whiskey trade of his city also were Jews. But it is not only the fact that the liquor business was controlled by Jews that assumes importance here. That's a fact which no one will deny, not even the Jewish defenders. But it's the additional fact that there was spread over this country the machinery of a vicious system, which, while it was destined to ruin the liquor business, as perhaps it deserved to be ruined, it also ruined hundreds of thousands of citizens who trusted that pure and unadulterated words that were intended to convey that message. It would be a separate story to tell of all the manipulation of labels, the piracy of brand names, the consciousness, play upon words, pure and unadulterated, of which the un-American compounded liquor compine was guilty. Of course, the stuff was pure and unadulterated, as they said. So is carbolic acid. But it was not whiskey. There were law violations galore, and it was well enough recognized in the rectifying business as a regular practice to appropriate annually a certain sum to pay the fines that were bound to be assessed against it. A riot of adulteration and chicanery ensued, with whiskey being made in many saloon cellars and the dangerous secrets of synthetic booze-making being peddled abroad among the customers of the trust. Presently, the saloon men became aware of the fact that they were the goats of the game. Seldom was the Jew engaged in dishing out 5-cent beers or 10-cent whiskeys. It remained for the boob Gentile to do that. The Jew was at the wholesale end where the real profits were being made. But it was the saloon man who took the brunt of the blame. The Jewish distillers, as they were called, as the compounders and blenders of the Louisville and Peoria districts were called, wore silk hats and their respectability was unquestioned. The saloon men made an 11th-hour effort to save their business, but the stuff they were pouring out had not improved, and prohibition came, sweeping the saloon away, but, as the sequel will show, not depriving the Jewish compounder of his profits. How much of the liquor business of the United States was in whiskey, and how much in rectified spirits? The 12th Census of the United States in 1900 said, "Most of the distilled liquors consumed as a beverage by the American people pass through rectifying houses. The different classes of rectified spirits range from the cheapest concoctions of neutral spirits and drugs to the simple blending of young and old whiskey. 20 years ago, statistics showed that 80% of the so-called whiskey put up in the United States was imitation whiskey. Chief Chemist Wiley, whose concern was not with the quantity but with the quality, gave it as his information that over half the whiskey in the country was compounded whiskey, less than half was genuine, and while they usually mix a little old whiskey with it, they often sell it purely and simply as it is, whiskey which has no claim to be called whiskey under the real meaning of that term." But all that was only a beginning. The time came when the vision of a great liquor combination rose in certain minds in this country. It was planned to sweep the good brands and the bad brands alike into one common management, whose control the reader will by this time suspect, and thus not only capitalize the reputation which the old-time American distillers had made through years of honest distilling, but use the trade names of pure goods as a mask for a deluge of the dishonest kind of liquor which left a trail of suicide, insanity, crime, and social wreckage in its path. This, with the independent testimony as to the Jewish direction of it all, will form the subject matter of a separate story. Well, that's the end of our first half of today's episode. This was published December 17th, 1921, in the Dearborn Independent. Well, there you have it. More testimony. Whatever the Jews touch turns to garbage. Imagine that. Let's move on to the next article, the second half of today's episode. This is entitled Gigantic Jewish Liquor Trust and Its Career. It has been shown how the American whiskey business became Jewish. The distillers of pure whiskey, which required years to make, were driven out by the manufacturers of drugged and chemicalized liquors, which could be made in 3 or 4 hours. The latter, being cheaper and more intoxicating, so completely usurped the market that the public never knew that it wasn't whiskey. It had stolen the name of whiskey, and under that name, the righteous indignation of the people prohibited it. And under that name, it is still being sold by bootleggers at an advance of 1,000%. The use of fraudulent label is not new. It's not a product of the Prohibition days. It began with the advent of Jewish capital into the liquor business. Whiskey, carefully and scientifically made, purified by long years of repose in the warehouse, was an American product. Red Eye, 40-rod stuff, Knock 'em Dead, and Squirrel Whiskey, mixed and sold the same day, were Jewish products. The Pure Food Law came into the fight to protect the American industry, but it was flouted at every turn. Bad liquor was in such a deep state of public disgrace that the people paid little attention to Chief Chemist Wiley's efforts. They thought when he said whiskey, he meant the stuff they knew as whiskey, and they disregarded him. The degeneracy of the liquor business became deeper and deeper, to the amazement of both its friends and its foes, and no one had the key to the situation because no one saw, or seeing, had the courage to expose the Jewish program behind the scenes. To resume the story, even after the cheap, compounded liquors which masqueraded as whiskey had won a commanding place in the market, to the serious detriment of the business and pure brands, the Jewish compounders were far from satisfied. There remained a few American brands whose names, by reason of their dependability, topped the list. Their very quality, though of limited quantity, was a constant challenge to the vicious mixtures of which the rectifiers produced millions of gallons a year. How to remove those standard American brands with their honest labels from the market? That was the problem which the leaders of the Jewish compounding business tackled. The first resort was, characteristically, to trickery. Shipments of pure goods would be sidetracked somewhere en route, while the rectifiers drew off half the whiskey and refilled the barrels with mixed compounds. People who have been amazed at the stunts of the bootleggers, the sidetracking of whiskey shipments, the robbery of loaded trucks, and so on, would not be so surprised if they knew that every trick was used by the compounders of bad liquor 20 years ago. It was Jewish then, as it is Jewish now, but no one dared say so. Merely to list the tricks would require too much space. It was a nasty business from any point of view. But still, the standard brands held their place in public confidence. The Jew who claims to be the superior of the American in skill did not think of making a better whiskey and thus winning the market. He thought to get rid of the better whiskey that the vicious, adulterated product might own the field. It was the day of trusts. Big business was amalgamating. It occurred to the leaders of the compounding business that if they could sweep all the honest distilleries into a combine with all the backroom rectifying places, put them all under one management, and run down the quality of famous brands to the standard of cheap ones, cashing in on the name of brands and doubly profiting by decreasing the cost which quality requires, they could thus accomplish in a financial way what had been formerly tried by less respectable methods. The inception of the idea of a whiskey combine was legitimate. The Kentucky distillers, who must at all times be distinguished from compounders and rectifiers, endeavored in 1898 to establish a combination that would unite all the legitimate distilleries in the fight against the flood of counterfeit whiskey. It is, however, significant that there was not enough capital in the legitimate whiskey business to finance the plan. But when the idea was picked up by the makers of spurious liquor, there were millions of dollars at their command. Just as today, with industry suffering, there are millions of Jewish capital at the disposal of the motion picture business. In the Louisville Courier Journal on February 1899, the story of the first operations toward a combine is told, the language being inflated, of course, that hesitant distilleries might be stampeded. Absorbed Kentucky distilleries in a mammoth combine, capital stock of $32 million. Some of the biggest plants in the state involved, 16 in Louisville, controls 90% of the product in nearly all standard brands. Levy Mayer of Chicago has acted as counsel in the drawing up of the papers. He becomes the general counsel of the new company. This article contained a list of Kentucky distilleries, all of them American, that is, non-Jewish. It was the well-established brands, the names of quality, that were sought. These names were all non-Jewish. Levy Mayer, the general counsel of the new company, said tonight, "The Kentucky Distilleries and Warehouse Company is a reality and will bring prosperity to the state of Kentucky, where depression has prevailed for some years on account of the discord which has existed among the distillers of bourbon whiskey, who, for a generation prior, enjoyed a great prosperity." A most ingenuous statement, but Mr. Mayer is a most ingenuous man. However, there is some truth in his statement. It was true that the legitimate distillers had suffered from depression, not because the American people were not consuming liquor, however, but because the American people had been turned from pure whiskey to red eye. And Mr. Mayer's smooth statement that this depression was on the account of the discord which has existed among the distillers of bourbon whiskey needs revision to the fight between the non-Jewish makers of real whiskey and the Jewish makers of compounded whiskey. In the story of the Combine, a great deal is heard of Mr. Mayer and Alfred Austrian. Mayer is a Chicago Jew who is worth a story by himself. He is one of those Jews with whom candidates for the American presidency, mostly those candidates who are in debt, feel it necessary to stay when he invites them. Mr. Austrian is sufficiently well known by his connection with the baseball scandal. He was attorney for Rothstein, Arnold Rothstein, the gambler whose name figured so prominently in that scandal and who is credited with doing things to the grand jury testimony in a way that makes a pretty tale. Austrian also appeared for two St. Louis Jew gamblers implicated in the baseball scandal who were afterward indicted. Austrian is also credited with being the author of the so-called Lasker Plan of baseball reorganization. The services of Mayer and Austrian to the liquor interests of Chicago and Cook County were and are important. There were Jewish names previously appearing. About 1889, Nathan Hoffheimer had tried to bring all the Kentucky whiskey business under one head, and later Morris Greenbaum tried it. It will probably be conceded that both these men are Jews, and it is provable by the records that they were endeavoring to consolidate the whiskey business. But the big stunt was really pulled off under the guidance of the two Chicago Jews, Mayer and Austrian. The various companies forming the trust are American Spirits Manufacturing Company, $35 million. Kentucky Distilling and Warehouse Association, $32 million. The Rye Whiskey Distillers Association, $30 million. The Standard Distilling Company, $28 million. And the Spirits Distributing Company of $7.5 million. The forerunner of the gigantic combination of the whiskey interests of the country was the organization of the American Spirits Manufacturing Company upon the ruins of the old whiskey trust which was controlled and erected by Joseph Greenhut. Attorney Levy Mayer of Chicago, who has been legal advisor of the whiskey people from the inception of the American Spirits Manufacturing Association, was called to New York Saturday last to confer over the legal form of the charter and the closing of the negotiations. The italicized portions indicate the connection, and it was a connection maintained to the end and may indeed be continued yet. Then, in the current accounts of this merger of the liquor business under Jewish control, another name appears. On March 15, 1899, Angelo Meyer, a big whiskey buyer of New York, is in Louisville trying to buy a big lot of whiskeys. It appears that Mr. Meyer put on a poor mouth and told how hard it was to buy whiskey in big lots. And then on March 17th, 2 days later, this appeared. Mr. Angelo Meyer, the wealthy Philadelphia whiskey man, has been appointed one of the general managers of the whiskey business of the Kentucky Distilleries Company, and is engaged in appointing men to take charge of the various departments of the Combine's affairs. The discrepancy in the above two paragraphs need not be charged to the untruthfulness of the newspaper reporter. Reporters, as a rule, faithfully report what they're told, but sometimes what they're told is not true. Mr. Meyer has commonly been called the Napoleon of the whiskey trade. He is largely interested in the recently formed Combine. We intend to make plenty of whiskey. No brand will be killed, said Mr. Meyer. Henceforth, the names of Levy Meyer, Alfred Austrian, and Angelo Meyer appear most frequently in the reports. Alfred Austrian, who is Levy Meyer's legal representative, says that all the distilleries now negotiated for will be absorbed in 3 weeks more. In an interview today, Mr. Angelo Meyer said, I believe confidently that in the next 5 years, a business calling for 10 million gallons of whiskey a year will be built up. In April 1899, another Jewish movement appeared. Joseph Wolf, the Chicago whiskey dealer, who is said to own more Kentucky whiskey, independent of the Kentucky Distilleries and Warehouse Company, than any other individual or corporation, is behind the new whiskey combine formed in Chicago with a capital stock of $3 million. The purpose of the new trust, which it is said will be given the title of the Illinois Distilleries and Warehouse Company, is to fight the Kentucky Distilleries and Warehouse Company. The few remaining Kentucky distillers were wary. They regarded Wolf, probably with reason, as stimulating enmity to the other part of the Jew-made whiskey trust in order to sweep into his net the remaining independents. Alfred Austrian and C.H. Stoll, attorneys for the Kentucky Distilleries and Warehouse Company, will leave Louisville today for Chicago to confirm with Levy D. Meyer, chief counsel for the trust, and in fact, counsel for three big whiskey and spirits combines. Alfred Austrian of Chicago left last night for Cincinnati to close the deal for the celebrated Sam Clay Distillery of Bourbon County. Under an exciting headline detailing the departure of the Jew lawyer Austrian to Chicago to see the Jew lawyer Meyer, there is the story of a still greater whiskey combine. The projected combination of all the whiskey interests of the country will probably be completed in Chicago today. A rye whiskey trust is now being formed and will soon be ready for incorporation and presentation to men with capital. It is said that the capitalization of the Rye Whiskey Trust will be $60 million, and the combined capitalization of the five companies will amount to about $175 million. Mr. Meyer of Chicago, Alfred Austrian of Chicago, and C.H. Stoll of New York are the attorneys for the three trusts, Mr. Meyer being the chief counsel. And still later, we have a statement from Mr. Mayor himself. The new rye distillery combination will be the largest individual whiskey amalgamation in the world. It is controlled and is being financed by the same people and the same trust companies of New York and Philadelphia, now controlling and financing the Kentucky Distilleries and Warehouse Company, whose capital is $32 million. The Standard Distilling and Distributing Company, with a capital of $28 million, the American Spirits Manufacturing Company, with a capital of $35 million, and the Spirits Distributing Company, with a capitalization of $15 million. Rumor has it, and Mr. Mayor smiled as he patted a big bundle of legal documents, that after the rye consolidation has been perfected, all the separate companies will be merged into one central company, which will have an aggregate capital close to $200 million. A whiskey combination of that size will certainly hold foremost place among the world's liquor trusts and organizations. Another dispatch saying this: Alfred Austrian today returned to Louisville from New York, where he assisted in forming the combine of the American Spirits Manufacturing Company and three other companies. Mr. Austrian leaves tonight for Chicago, where he expects to close the deal with Elias Bloke and Sons to produce the Darling Distillery in Carroll County, with Freiberg and Warkham to secure their two plants in Boone County. Here it's possible to see the Jewish agents of Jewish capital hurrying to and fro with every assurance of success, working along well-defined lines, known to themselves but concealed from the public, building up a colossal structure which public opinion was to hurl down in 2 decades. But 2 decades were enough for enormous revenues to be derived from the criminal debasement of all kinds of liquor, which became more apparent from the time of the giant consolidation. Whiskey became so rotten that in Kentucky, the pioneer whiskey state, there were only 4 whole wet counties by 1908. The first decade of absolute Jewish control put even the first whiskey state in the dry column. The Jewish compounders did not care how they marketed their goods, so long as they could sell them in quantities. The cheap barrel house appeared with its windows full of gleaming bottles and gaudy labels and cut-rate whiskey prices. The compounders became saloon owners toward the end of the saloon era, and many Jews went into the barrel house business for a quick cleanup. The proportion of vicious dives increased everywhere, and the moral guardians of society were amazed at the wave of vice that was sweeping over the country. But they did not have the key that explained it all. The whiskey business was riding to a wild finish, but the men at the helm knew exactly what they were doing every moment of the time. To look back upon that period, with all the facts at hand, makes it more and more apparent how fitting is the term boob Gentile. Why, even Norman Hapgood knew how bad it was, and Collier's Weekly, under his editorship, was the first journal in the land to print the names of Jews in connection with the liquor debauchery of the country. But those were the good old days, when Hapgood could tell the truth even about Hearst, the man for whom he now writes his graceless pavler of pro-Jewish propaganda. In Collier's Weekly, during the year 1908, solid truths appeared which are in point today as proofs of what was transpiring. There was a specially scathing attack on what was called nigger gin, a peculiarly vile beverage which was compounded to act upon the Negro in a most vicious manner. Will Irwin spoke of this gin as the king iniquity in the degenerated liquor traffic of these United States. This author, and Collier's started a new fashion in giving publicity not only to the names of certain brands of liquors, but also the names of the men who made them. It turned out that the maker of a brand of nigger gin, which had spurred certain Negroes onto the nameless crime, was one Levi. Mr. Irwin wrote this. Because the South is not through with Lee Levy, and because its citizens may at least drive him out of business, if they cannot get him behind the bars, one declaration of the commercial appeal is worthy of reply. That paper raises a question of fact. It charges that Levy's gin, Dreyfus, Whale & Company's gin, Blumenthal and Blickert's gin, the Old Spring Distilling Company's gin, do not exist, or that, if they exist, their sales are insignificant. Let me present my own evidence on that point. Mr. Irwin then details some of his experiences. The gin which he was discussing was provocative of peculiar lawlessness. Its labels bore lascivious suggestions and were decorated with highly indecent portraiture of white women. I bought, for evidence, many other brands, some emanating from the big liquor cities, and some put up by the local people. But I could always get Levy's. I never saw it in any saloon which bars the Negro. In Galveston, which prides itself on its clean government, some brand or other was for sale in nearly all the corner grocery drums. In a Negro street of New Orleans, I saw 5 saloon shop windows in one block, which displayed either Lee Levy's or Dreyfus, Weil & Company's. This latter firm is more clever in its work than the others, much more delicate and subtle in its labeling policy. It takes one who understands the Negro and his slang to appreciate the enigma of their wording. It all comes in a caution label on the obverse of his bottles. Such gins were sold everywhere in Birmingham. A bottle of the stuff, half empty, had been taken from a Pickens County Negro just after his arrest for the nameless crime. Levy, so the gossip of the liquor trade has it, grew rich through this department of his business. Dreyfus Whale & Company advertise everywhere that theirs is the most widely sold brand in the South, and more one hears of tragedies that lie at the end of this course. That's just a sample here, reader. A specific sample of what went on in every part of the country. Newspaper reporters will remember how the police used to wonder about the change that came over certain foreign communities. They come here nice people, the experienced police captain would say, but in a short time they're all driving us all sorts of trouble. They don't go do that in their own country. It's the drink, somebody would suggest. No, they drink in their own country. They drink all the time there. It's the kind of drink they get here that does it. The rot gut. That's what drives them wild. That was the captain's diagnosis, made 1,000 times, but no one was the wiser. No one saw the key, which was the Jew. In the South, a terrible lynching period came and divided the country into pro-lynching and pro-Negro parties, but still no one saw the reason for it all. The race question rose to threatening proportions. The Americans of the North and South looked at each other askance. There was a cooling of sympathy between the regions. Northerners were inclined to look at Southerners as unjust and inhuman in their treatment of the Negro, and Southerners were inclined to look upon Northerners as temperamentally unsympathetic and stupidly ignorant of what the conditions were. Behind it all were the products of men like Lee Levy and Dreyfus, Weil & Company, to use only the names quoted from Collier's. The ancient Jewish policy of divide, conquer, destroy was in operation. Jewish policy favors disunion as a preparation to the kind of union which Jewish leaders want. Jewish influence was strong for disunion in the Civil War. Jewish influence is directly behind the present attitude of the Negro toward the white man. Look at the so-called Negro welfare societies with their hordes of Jewish officials and patrons. Jewish influence in the South is today active in keeping up the memory of the old divisions. And, with reference to the Negro question, nigger gin is the product of Jewish poisoned liquor factories, and it was its most provocative element. Trace the appearance of this gin as to date, and you will find the period when Negro outbursts and lynching became serious. Trace the localities where this gin was most widely sold, and you will find the places where these disorders prevailed. It is extremely simple, so simple that it's been overlooked. The public is being constantly deceived by an appearance of complexity where there is none. When you find the fever-bearing mosquito, yellow fever is no longer a mystery. The same policy of divide, conquer, destroy tells the story of the liquor traffic. Jewish influence divided between distilling and compounding, drove out distilling, and in the end destroyed the traffic as a legalized entity. It needs to be said, however, that the destruction is not part of the Jewish intention. Divide and conquer is the formula as the Jewish leaders conceive it, as, indeed, it is stated in the protocols. The destroy comes as nemesis upon Jewish achievements. Russia was divided and conquered, but just as the Jews had conquered it, the cankerworm of fate began to consume their conquest. The story is repeated wherever Jewish intrigue has succeeded. Whatever the Jews can succeed in making Jewish falls. It may be fate. It may be destiny's way to the survival of the fittest. That which succumbs to complete Judaization, as Jewish leaders conceive it, may deserve to fall. The justification of its destruction may appear in the possibility of its Judaization. Anything that can be Judaized is to that extent sentenced to oblivion. The story of Jewish control of liquor has now been carried through two stages, the divide and conquer stages. The third stage follows with swift and relentless steps. Blind though the country was to the Jewish character of the liquor business, it was not blind to the ravages of that business upon society. There came a sentiment that moved ceaselessly through the country and mounted to stormy power. People could only speak of it as a wave. The term became hackneyed by overuse, but it was accurately descriptive. The indignation of the people, the arousal of their just moral resentment, was as a flood which rose to cleanse the land. The attack was on liquor, and the attack was just. The attack was on liquor, and it came none too soon. The country was drenched in vile concoctions which rapidly undermined large sections of the population. Crime increased, and domestic misery was everywhere. The people attacked the only thing they could see. They attacked the stuff and the places that distributed it. They did not see the $200 million Jewish whiskey combination. They did not see the sinister devices by which strong drink was made vile and viler with the growth of Jewish control. The people rose and swept away the saloon. They did not sweep away the stocks of liquor. They did not sweep away Jewish interest in liquor. They left the source untouched, and that source is still existent. There remains another chapter of the narrative, the coming of prohibition and of the illicit traffic in liquor. It remains to be seen whether the same thread carries through the latter phases. That's the end of the second half of today's episode. This was published December 24th, 1921. So there you have it. Some background on the control of the liquor business, which I'm sure none of the listeners are surprised by. That kind of goes without saying for a lot of people who are into the mob and into bootlegging and all that kind of history. It's very interesting stuff, no doubt, and the Jews were powerful in that, and like we discussed, anything the Jews put their hands on or gain control of, they eventually run it in the ground. They adulterate it, they water it down, they ruin it. That's what they do. They are nation wreckers, they are destroyers. Well, I don't know how much more I can say on this particular topic. I think these two articles that we read pretty well cover it. It is amazing. They were talking about divide and control, divide and conquer. What was the term they used for it? Divide, conquer, destroy. I came to learn it as another term, but the Jews are excellent at this. The Jews are excellent at creating a problem, getting the public all worked up, and then making the public beg for a more terrible condition than the problem to get rid of that said problem. The Jews are excellent at that, and they're excellent at misdirecting the outrage and the public consciousness toward the problem. They did it with liquor. They do it with everything, it seems. Crime, for instance. Guns is another thing. They want to ban the guns, and not get at the root of the problem. They just want to blame guns when really, with a lot of these crimes, we ought to look at the Jew behind the curtain, the Jew in control of the drug and liquor business, and understand that I get people want to ban it. I get that white women had their families ruined and thought prohibition was the answer. I totally get it. From their point of view, they thought that would solve things and make things better and improve their lot in life. Unfortunately, when you have Jewish gangsters that control a given commodity, i.e. liquor, alcohol, the Jews love prohibition. That means their profit potential just skyrocketed, went through the roof. You have to take away the profit motive from the Jew. That's the only real way you can clamp down on them and stop societal problems. That's the angle that needs to be taken with a lot of these problems, with a lot of these issues, and unfortunately, we just don't have any societal watchdogs. The media is not going to do it. The government's not going to point this out. The politicians aren't going to point it out. No one's going to point out the Jew behind the curtain making all the money and promoting all these traffics, all these trades in illicit goods, whether it's liquor or it's heroin. And Christians naively think that, oh, if we just pass a law banning or prohibiting this or that, we'll put a stop to it. No, you're wrong. That's not going to solve the problem. I get where you're coming from, but you got to look at it from a higher perspective. You got to take away the profit motive from the Jews. And that's really the only way to stop it. Getting the Jews out of your country is probably a very good, the Jews and all their merchandise, put an embargo on them, shut down trade with them, do not let them in, kick them out, get them out of the money system, get them out of Wall Street and speculation, shut all the Jew monkey business, making money, illicit trades, speculation, the financial world, shut all that down. Suffocate the Jew from his power. That's how you do it. Take the money power away. Anything less and patting yourself on the back thinking you're going to put a stop to it, you're pissing in the wind. You're fooling yourself. You've got to take the money power, the profit motive away from the Jew. And if you don't, and if you let them run wild and do what they want, guess what? You end up where we are 100 years after these articles and all these 4 volumes of the International Jew were written. You end up with the world we have today. Pure madness and degeneration. Well, I think I've said enough here. I don't want to go on too far a tangent. I hope my ranting and rambling has been clear enough, and I hope I'm conveying to you how this thing works, the bigger picture, at least as I understand it, and as Henry and his editors have written and elucidated here. So until next time, guys, this is Ted Midward signing off for Radio Aryan. Praise Christ, praise Yahweh, take care, bye-bye.
tuned into Radio Aryan.